Today is the 20th of February, Monday night at Sheret Israel. This week's Torah portion is Parshat Truma, but we're not going to study Parshat Truma. We're going to study last week's Parsha, which is Parshat Mishpatim. The reason we're doing that is twofold. Number one, we didn't have a class last week, so we missed Mishpatim. I want to go back and do Mishpatim. That's the first reason. The second reason is that Parshat Truma and the three or four parshiot that follow it are all about the construction of the tabernacle. And the material gets rather repetitious. And probably if we did Parshat Truma today, I wouldn't have anything to say in another 2 weeks. We'd run out of what to learn about because of the repetition. So it actually is very helpful that we'll do Mishpatim. We'll be a week behind and we'll end the book of Exodus together with the book of Exodus. We'll take 3 weeks to do four parshiot, something like that. Everything will work out fine, I hope. Within Parshat Mishpatim, there are at least 100 subjects, if not more, we can talk about in last week's parsha, because it's the richest collection of civil law in the whole Torah. Almost every verse is a new law that literally thousands of pages have been written on in Jewish history on each verse in Parshat Mishpatim in last week's parsha. We're going to focus on two verses there that at least 1,000 books have been written on, and these two verses. Because these two verses are the foundation of just about everything Judaism has to say about the raging, difficult conundrum of abortion. It all goes back to two verses in the book of Exodus and last week's Torah portion, Parshat Mishpatim. So, we'll look at these verses, of course, and we'll look at them very, very carefully. But we cannot look at them in the Jewish Publication Society translation, and we can't look at them in the Art Scroll, because those two translations already prejudice the reading of the verses. I want to look at a translation that gives you the translation exactly, literally, word for word, giving no interpretation and not moving, not swerving to one side or the other, so we can be blank slates and ask ourselves, well, what does this verse actually mean? And we'll see at least three different possible interpretations. Only one of those three is the Jewish interpretation. But the other three might just fit into the verses, and they were interpretations available to readers of the Torah 2,000 years ago, readers outside of traditional Judaism. So, we move to the second page in the handout, which is the back of the first page, to look at a translation of Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 and 23, that is completely free of any interpretation. At the top right-hand corner of the second side of the first page, and I wrote there page one, as if to say the first page is page minus one. The Hebrew says, and I'll read the Hebrew in English, V'chi yinatsu anashim, and if men strive together, V'nagfu isha hara, and they hurt a woman who is pregnant, V'yatsu yiladeha, which literally means went forth her children. This English translation says her fruit depart, which is fine. Yatsu yiladeha, and it could be many people in the room know those two Hebrew words. Yatsu means to go out, to go forth, to come out. Yiladeha are her children. So she was pregnant, and she got hit inadvertently by men fighting, and yatsu yiladeha. Her children, her fruit, her fetus, or her fetuses, came forth. V'lo yiyeh ason, and there will not be any harm. The Hebrew word for harm is ason, which almost always means tragedy, death, disaster. That's what happened. Somehow, there was no tragedy, death, disaster, harm, but there was a condition of yatsu yiladeha. She's no longer pregnant. Her fetus or fetuses came forth. What do we do? What's the law? So it says, Anosh ye anesh kasher yashit alav bal haisha, which means will be punished as the husband will decide, v'natan biflilim, and it should be paid as the judges determine. That's verse 22. Now, to translate verse 22 into modern terms, there was here a inadvertent and accidental abortion. That's what happened, right? These men meant to kill each other, and instead the woman got in the way, and an abortion was caused,
That's the wrong word. It's miscarriage.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm being very careful here not to say miscarriage. That already prejudices. But you know what, Jim, you're right. I also shouldn't have said abortion. I shouldn't have said miscarriage, and I shouldn't have said abortion. I already said too much. I said things that are not written in the verses. So Jim's right. I shouldn't have said any of that. All it says is, Yatsu Yeladeya, her children came forth, and we don't know what that means. Good.
Children came forth, but not alive.
It doesn't say.
Okay.
But you actually now brought the discussion into play here. Because that's what it doesn't say. Did her children come forth dead or alive? And a further question we can ask, did her children come forth formed or unformed? All that it doesn't say. But whatever happened that's described in those two words, v'yatsu yeladeh, whatever happened, we don't know, it's clearly not a capital issue. It's not a capital issue. It's not described as a son. It's not described as tragedy. It's not described as harm. It's not described as death. It's described as something that calls forth a monetary reaction. Right? Some type of monetary reaction, some type of monetary penalty is the result, is the consequence of this condition in which one man or two men caused a state that's described as Yatsu Yeladeya. Then verse 23 goes on to say, V'imason Yehiyeh, but if harm will follow, if tragedy will follow, if death will follow, that's what the word ason means, then v'natata nefesh tachat nefesh, then you should give life for life. So there is something that could happen that's called ason, that's called tragedy, that's called harm, that's called death, and if that something happens, whatever it is, then you should give life for life. That's a capital case. But what happened in the first description, in verse 22, of Yatsu Yeladeh, our children came forth, whatever that means, that's not a capital issue. That is not a matter of murder, apparently. But it's a tort case. It's a case that calls forth a monetary fine. Okay. That's what we know. But of course, now we have to interpret, because that's not enough to figure out exactly what this teaches us. So then we ask, well, was this a miscarriage? Was this abortion? What state were the Yeladeya, her children, in when they left her womb in this unnatural fashion? So let's try and think of the possibilities. And whenever we bring up possibilities, we have to bring up two possibilities, verse 22 and verse 23. So let's begin.
So
I'm going to write down what you say.
All right. So when she was accidentally hit, it could have just caused a premature birth.
It
could have been alive.
Okay, so verse 22, it could be a live premature birth. Live premature birth, which of course implies that the fetus was fully formed. If it's live.
Premature, it might have been mature for that matter. Maybe it just put her into labor,
right,
and she was going to give birth within 3 days anyway. I mean, not even necessarily premature.
Right, so I'll just write live birth.
Yeah.
Okay? And if that's what verse 22 is talking about, which is a tort case, then verse 23, that says it's a capital case, what happened then in that case?
Nothing.
Say again?
I mean, not a life for an eye. I mean, not a life for a life.
No, verse 23 says a life for a life.
Right, so therefore it wouldn't apply. If it was born
now,
alive.
What's the scenario in case 23? And it says, and if there was a tragedy, if there was harm, then life for life. So what happened? What's it?
Child died.
Still born.
Child died.
Yeah.
Child died.
Well, the mother child died. Was born and then died.
There is more to talk about. Let's talk about simple cases. So it could be that verse 23 is talking about a stillborn.
Yeah.
And here, the proper word is miscarriage?
Yeah.
Assuming you make that assumption.
Yeah.
If we're talking about a stillborn, then I should write miscarriage, right? If that's what we're talking about.
Is the tragedy, does it also include the mother, if the mother died?
Very good question. Mm-hmm. So let's just, miscarriage, did I spell it right?
I-A-J-E.
I-A-J-E. Okay. No.
Miscarriage. C-A-R-R-I-A-J-E.
Well, we know what it means.
We know what you mean.
C-A-R-R.
Just forget the vowels and just...
Yeah, there you go.
That's good enough.
Okay. That is one possibility in looking at the two verses as a unit, that when it says the children came forth, that means a live birth. And the law there is it's a tort case. Tort case would mean that the men who caused it have to pay the woman for her pain, for her embarrassment, for her suffering. But it's not a capital case. When does it become a capital case? If, as verse 23 says, if tragedy ensued, we'll interpret that to mean that the child came out dead, miscarriage, and that says life for life. That's a capital case. That's one reading of the verses, and we're going to call that A.
Can I take one step back?
Yes.
Does it make a difference if it's men or women who caused the action?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But usually women don't fight like these men were.
Usually.
Rhonda.
Are you ready for someone to propose a different
yes.
thing that happened?
So let's put another possibility. I should have written A here, right? That's possibility A. And if I had a different color of marker, I would write B in a different color. But I don't. Okay, so what's another way of reading the verses? We'll call it B.
Well, I was thinking that when it says, and yet no harm follow, maybe that means that she's still able to have children. But when it says, but if any harm follow, maybe she can't have children after this accident or something.
Okay, good. I'm not going to write that on the board because it doesn't fall into my preconceived notions of what was said 2,000 years ago. But that doesn't mean it doesn't make sense.
Okay. All right.
Well, in B, it has nothing to do with the child. It has everything to do with the mother.
Okay. Right. So that's very possible that verse 22 is about the child, verse 23 is about the mother.
No.
Oh.
Both 22 and 23 are about the mother.
No, 22 can't be at the mother because it says, Yatsu Yeladeir, children came forth, and that's the reason for the penalty. So we'll say that in our second interpretation, 22 is about the child, 23 is about the mother. Now, if 23 is about the mother and it says life for life, what happened to the mother?
She died.
Right. So, in this case, it's going to be the woman dies.
Is it possible the woman dies and the child lives?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's also possible a woman dies and the child dies.
Right, that's also possible.
It's irrelevant as to what happens to the...
So, if the woman dies... What we're being told that is, if someone dies, then it's considered a tragedy and give life for life. But then, what happened in the first verse, verse 22, when it says came forth her children, and that's a tort case? So I'm going to write here that it means a stillborn, stillborn, and the word we use again is miscarriage. Miscarriage. What would that mean? That would mean that her child came forth. I made the mistake?
Yeah.
Well, no. I was just going to comment.
On the spelling?
No, go ahead. No, I was just going to comment.
Just comment.
Well, then the definition of tragedy would only apply to the death of the woman.
Right.
If you can have a death
right.
of the child in both cases.
Right. And according to the B reading, the tragedy only applies to the woman. And let's just parse it again. So verse 22 says that the child came forth. In B, we're reading that as came forth dead, stillborn. And that's a tort case. It's not a capital case. But verse 23 says, but if tragedy ensued, meaning if the woman died, not, quote unquote, just a fetus, but if the woman died, then that's a capital case. That's another way of parsing the verses. And now I want to move to a third way. A third way has to do with similar to A, in that in both verses we're talking about the child. However, if we're talking about the child, we can divide it up between 22 and 23, not only between a live birth and a miscarriage, but we can divide up as to different stages of formation of the fetus. And we could say, and I'm going to call this C, that when it says in verse 22 that her child went forth, and it's only a tort case, it's only money, that's because the child that came forth was undeveloped. So I'm going to write here, let's call it miscarriage of undeveloped fetus. And that's telling us, if the fetus is undeveloped and this mischief of the men caused such a miscarriage, that is a tort case. But, verse 23, if there was a tragedy, meaning that a fully developed but stillborn fetus came out, that's already life for life. Let me just put that on the board. I'm going to write here...
Full term.
Do I live birth? Just live birth? I'm sorry, dead birth. All right. You're right. We're going to write here fully miscarriage of a fully formed. The miscarriage of fully formed fetus.
So do we assume A was... What do we assume A is for 23?
Miscarriage means death.
But so is C.
So it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't matter
okay.
What stage.
Okay, what happens if, you know, you have a live birth, but then they have some developmental issues that was caused...
Okay, that's something that's complicated okay. That I want to deal with these okay. Three. The reason I'm pushing for these three is not only because they're possible and plausible and logical, it's because these three interpretations were brought up over 2,000 years ago. We're about to see that. So let's just now, Erev Tov, let's just look on the board and sum up the consequences in modern 21st century language of reading like A, of reading like B, and of reading like C. So if we read like A, that if a live birth ensued, that's verse 22, that's the tort case, whereas if a miscarriage ensued, that's the capital case. So tell me, what political party is that in 21st century terms?
I'll say,
what political party would read the verses like A? What candidate who's now campaigning?
Rick Santorum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how Rick Santorum reads the verses. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That if there was an inadvertent miscarriage, if two men did something, and one man did something inadvertently, that caused an abortion, right? The child is dead. Netata nefesh tachat nefesh, give life for life. That's telling you that a child who is caused to die before it would have been born is defined as a capital case. Okay? That's Rick Santorum. I can just write here Rick Santorum on the board. On the other hand, if I read like B, let's read like B. And B says that if... You know, I actually want to write Rick Santorum there. It's going to be fun. Santorum. Santorum. It's so important to me to show how American politics of 21st century is right here in interpretation of the verses. So let's read like B. Verse 22, which is the tort case, says... that these men were fooling around, then they were hitting each other and fighting, and they caused a miscarriage. They caused this perfectly healthy fetus to die and to be expelled from the womb. That is a tort case. That's a tort case. It's not a capital case. And when do we have a capital case? Only when the woman dies. Verse 22. When there's tragedy, there's a son, meaning the woman dies, then it's give life for life. And what B means is, what? Oh, tell me who holds that B?
Obama.
Obama, right? B is Obama. B is Obama. Which, what does it mean? What does it mean? It means the only way in this scenario to talk about a capital case, to talk about murder, is if a woman dies. But as far as the child goes, we're not talking about murder. It'll never be murder because the stillborn is only considered to be a tort case. Okay, so that's Santorum, that's Obama.
Actually, Rabbi, that's not fair to Obama. We don't need to get into politics. That's the Supreme Court. And Obama is not that radical. Santorum, as a Tea Party person, you can I will buy off on that, but I'd respectfully ask you to take that off because that's just not right.
Well, but if you
it's not, that's not Obama.
She said it.
I said it.
Not him.
You can say liberal Democrats.
But it's Jim. Are you
that
really?
Is, I object. That is wrong. That's just wrong. That is not Obama's position.
Well, but Obama. So if you look at some of his stuff, you can go back and say whether you agree or not, partial birth abortion.
That's too broad of a paintbrush.
Okay, look, so I'm going to compromise. I'm going to put Obama in parentheses, okay? Obviously, my purpose here is not to, you know, get into politics, but this makes it meaningful. Okay, now, who holds like C? C is a more complicated case. C says that if in verse 22, when it says, Yetsu Yiladei, our children came forth, what came out of her womb was something that barely looked like a human being, right? That's a tort case. But if what came out of her womb was a fully formed fetus, then you're already talking about a capital case. Verse 23. So, that's a case that basically says that partial birth abortion is murder, whereas other abortion in an earlier part of the term, are not, right? Who holds like that? I really don't know. Tell me.
I think that's actually kind of closest in general to certain state laws and...
Give me a state that I can write.
Well, not as far as abortion goes. Let's leave abortion. But for example, I might be wrong, but in cases where a pregnant woman is murdered or a drunk driver hits her, the viability of her fetus comes mm-hmm. into play, and whether or not it's a double murder.
Mm-hmm.
So
good.
That's
good.
A great point.
Good, right? But I still want a political person to put here. Help me out. Is there
Ron
anyone?
Ron Paul?
Sitting in? Is that true?
Should I put no, he's an OB-GYN. He deliver a lot of it.
Okay, so we understand what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next stage is to go back in history 2,000 years. And to see who held like A, and who held like B, and who held like C. That's the first page of my handout. The real first page. The one that is before page one. And there are three different sources that I brought here. Actually, four I brought. We're going to read them, and we're going to decide together if they hold like A, if they hold like B, or if they hold like C. The first source is Josephus Flavius, who, to make a very long story short, was a Jew who lived 2,000 years ago.
It isn't. Mr. Fallen out of your book.
Great, thank you very much. Who lived 2,000 years ago. He was actually a Jewish general in the war against Rome in the year 70. His forces in the Galilee were defeated, and he turned himself into the Romans and became a historian for the Roman armies and later for the whole Roman Empire. He wrote basically three books in Greek that bring to the Greco-Roman world information about Jews and the Jewish people and about Torah. He's not a scholar, but he went to Hebrew school when he was a kid. He knows something about the way the Jews think about the Bible and the way the Jews think about history and about morals. In his book, Contra Opionem, he writes as follows. He that kicks a woman with child so that the woman miscarries, let him pay a fine in money, as the judge shall determine, as having diminished the multitude by the destruction of what was in her womb. In other words, there's less people on the earth. And let money also be given to the woman's husband by he that kicked her. So does he hold like A, like B, or like C?
B.
B. Looks like you're right. Looks like B. He's relating to verse 22. He's not relating to verse 23. Relating to verse 22. And he says that's a miscarriage. Notice the Yatsu Yeladeh, our children came forth. Even though they came forth without life, it's still only a tort case and not a capital case. So Josephus Flavius holds like B. Fine. But now we're going to read Josephus in a different work of his, in his Antiquities of the Jews, his work of history. And there he writes the following. The law orders, and law means Torah, of course, all offspring to be brought up, and forbids women either to cause abortion or to make away with the fetus. A woman convicted of this is considered a murderess, because she destroys a living creature and diminishes the race. He's not relating to our verses directly, but if we use his moral principles to apply them to our verse, does he hold like Obama Santorum or C?
This time it's Santorum.
This is Santorum, right? Josephus contradicts himself, and there's so much literature on how Josephus can contradict himself. We don't really have to ask ourselves how it can happen. He's not a scholar. Whatever reason, we don't know. Perhaps different audiences, but he's presenting two different approaches of what he wants the Greco-Roman world to believe that the Jews believe. Okay? And it's either, like we said, it's either a Santorum or Obama. Next, we're going to look at the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the translation into Greek of the Torah, done quite a while before the Common Era, before the beginning of the Common Era, translated Hebrew into Greek by Jews for the use of the Greco-Roman world, both for the use of Jews who don't speak Hebrew but only speak Greek, and as well for Gentiles. And in the Septuagint's translation of our verses into Greek, we read as follows. And of course, this is an English translation of the Greek. If two men wrestle with one another and hit a pregnant woman, and the child comes forth and is not formed yet, then the penalty shall be a monetary penalty. But if it was formed, then thou shalt give life for life. That's clear, right? That's C. So we see here that over 2,000 years ago, we already have these three interpretations on the table available in different works.
Is there 2,000 anything years ago. That talks about what formed really means, like how many weeks?
Let's see the next source.
Okay.
The next source is Philo of Alexandria, who is a scholarly Jew living in Alexandria, not in the land of Israel, in the first century of the Common Era. He was the leader of the largest Jewish community in the world at that point, after the destruction, about the same time, after the destruction of Jewry in the land of Israel, after the destruction of the temple, Livriut. And although he was the leader of the Jews of Alexandria, it's not clear if he knew Hebrew at all. And many say he learned Torah in Greek. What do you mean in Greek? He read the Septuagint. And when we read his commentaries on the Torah, and he wrote many, many, many commentaries on the Torah and on Judaism, he is disconnected from the rabbinic tradition, basically his own tradition that came to an end, a tradition that didn't have follow-up within the Jewish people. And he writes as follows: but if anyone has a contest in the sense of a battle, with a woman who is pregnant, and strike her a blow on her belly, and she miscarry, if the child which was conceived within her is still unfashioned and unformed, he shall be punished by a fine, both for the assault which he committed, and also because he has prevented nature, who is fashioning and preparing that most excellent of all creatures, a human being, from bringing him into existence. But if the child which was conceived had assumed a distinct shape in all its parts, having received all its proper connective and distinctive qualities, he shall die. For such a creature as that is a man, whom he has slain while still in the workshop of nature, who had not thought it yet a proper time to produce him to the light, but had kept him like a statue, lying in a sculptor's workshop, requiring nothing more than to be released and sent out into the world. So clearly, Philo holds like the Septuagint, which you see on the board, that abortion can be a capital case, but only if the fetus is completely and fully formed, looks like the ninth month, whereas anything earlier, if a abortion or a miscarriage is caused in the first 8 months, it looks like Philo would say, based on Septuagint, that it is a tort case, not a capital case. Okay? That's stage one. And now, no, don't turn the page. Now I'm going to ask you, well, what do you think the rabbinic tradition holds by? Is it A, is it B, or is it C?
I always thought rabbinic tradition doesn't consider it a life until it's born.
Okay. And
but
if,
I don't know what
and
I'm
if Lori's right, that would mean that Jewish tradition holds like B. That's Lori's suggestion, that rabbinic tradition holds like B, which could be. Anyone have any other approach or
well,
opinion?
Well, the mother's
or?
Life, I thought, also takes precedence. So, from that.
Right, the mother's life takes precedence over the fetus. Okay, and if that's so, that would seem to be assuming that the fetus is not on the same level of life as the woman, which is what basically what Laurie is saying. Right, so that's two votes for Obama, as
well,
it were.
I didn't say that, though, because...
Okay.
I mean... from an Orthodox standpoint, where isn't it, so many menstrual cycles or something like that? There's something, if you've missed a certain amount, then it's considered more than just, somebody wouldn't, I think after the first cycle or something like that, there's more to it than just...
I see. So you're moving towards C. You're moving towards C, basically. You're saying it depends how...
Well, yeah, I guess, And I guess it depends, obviously at that time there was only Orthodox Judaism anyway.
But I thought it's not considered a, quote, soul until it's born.
Okay, so you're pushing for B. You're pushing for B. I'm not saying anything.
Oh, okay.
Well, back then.
Okay, let's do one more. Does anyone else want to express an opinion? Okay. I want to do one more thing before we turn the page, which is the following. Let's just think for a minute, not just what are the plausible interpretations, and not just what you think rabbinic tradition might hold, but which of these three do you think is more or less plausible? Like looking in the verse, which fits more, which fits less?
I mean, I just like C. I think I just like it. Personally.
Which one do you like?
I like C.
You like C.
I find the Septuagint fascinating. I vote C, but I think that's a personal
one. Okay. Okay, so if Alexandria is talking about C.
Kind of a middle road, too.
A middle road. I would look at the verse and say, exegetically, C is the one that adds the most material into the verse that's not there. Right? Because C demands of us to make a rather fine distinction between different stages of development. And I would say, if I'm looking for the simplest, most straightforward meaning of the verse, well then, the interpretation that adds the least amount of material that's not there, that's the more likely one. But one that adds material and information and assumptions that's not there, that makes it less plausible. So I wouldn't vote for C as far as which fits in a more seamless fashion into the verse. Right.
When I first read it, I thought B. I thought the child dies in verse 22, the woman is harmed or dies in verse 23. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the most straightforward reading.
It certainly is straightforward. It is straightforward. A is certainly plausible. They're all plausible. But the problem with A is that I have to say that verse 22 is talking about a very, very specific case. A woman who is pregnant in her ninth month. Otherwise, how was there a live birth? If I want... You see what I'm saying?
You can have a live birth
In the eighth and a half, okay. But in other words, for the vast majority of a pregnancy, there wouldn't be a live birth. And the verse just says she was pregnant. It doesn't say what stage she was pregnant. So I would say, like Rhonda said, the most straightforward reading is like B. Because in B, I don't have to limit the scenario. I can just say it's talking about a regular pregnant woman. First month, ninth month, it's all the same. It's all the same. If she was struck in her tummy and there was a miscarriage and the child left her, then in any case, stillborn, and all the more so if it was a live birth, it's just a tort case. And when does it become a capital case? Only if she died. But that's the easiest way to read the verses, because we don't have to add material that's not written there. We don't have to limit the scenario to part of what it says. It says a pregnant woman, so I'll say it's any pregnant woman. Doesn't limit it, so it's not limited. So really, I would say that B is the most straightforward reading. C is the most convoluted reading. And A, it could be, but it still does limit the verses a little bit. But all that's as far as exegesis goes. In other words, what makes sense is interpretation. But as far as what's available, all three are available. We saw 2,000 years ago, they're all there. But so what do the rabbis hold? Here we go. An issue, a question?
You know what, I'll hold off my...
Okay, so what do the rabbis hold? What does Jewish tradition hold? So we're on the page that's the back of the first page, and I called it 1. We're going to look at, to streamline this, let's look at the source that's right next to the verses. It's the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael, the Masechta de Nezikin, chapter 8. The Mechilta is the Tanaitic halachic commentary to the book of Exodus. I'll say that again. It's the Tanaitic halachic commentary to the book of Exodus. Tanaitic means rabbis who lived before the year 200 of the Common Era. And halachic, I mean legal as opposed to non-legal. It's the ancient, the early rabbinic commentary on the halachic matters in the book of Exodus. In the legal matters in the book of Exodus, and it, as all legal matters, it is complicated. It says, what then is the purpose of saying it if men strive together? That's our verse 22. What is the halachic point of that verse that says if her children go forth, whatever that means, it's only a tort case? What does that come to teach us? What's the legal point that we would not have known if we didn't have this verse? Because it says, and he that smiteth anybody mortally, Leviticus 24:17, let's look it up. If you have in front of you the Torah, the Chumash, look in Leviticus, Vayikra 24:17. And it says as follows. If anyone kills a human being, he shall be put to death. Right? That's what the verse says. And the Hebrew says, "Kol ki yakeh kol nefesh adam," and he that smiteth anybody mortally shall be put to death. That's what it says in Leviticus. So what this source, this midrash, is doing, it say the following. We have this verse in Leviticus which is very clear. It says if you kill anyone, you are put to death. Well, what is our verse in Exodus adding over and above that? What is it adding? Let's read more of the sentence. Wait a second. Let's read slowly. Which I might understand to mean, even if he kills a child born after only 8 months of pregnancy. In other words, the verse in Leviticus, because it said, if anyone strike kol nefesh adam, any soul of a man, I might have thought that that word kol, all, any, comes to include even a child born after only 8 months of pregnancy. And if in Leviticus, it's already telling me that even a child that's born not viable, born such that it probably is going to die because the pregnancy wasn't to full term, if Leviticus is already telling me that even in that case, you are liable for murder if you kill the child, then what more could Exodus be teaching me? Let's see the answer. What more could Exodus be teaching me? And the answer is, therefore it says, and if men strive together, thereby telling us that one is not guilty of death unless he kills a viable child. Viable child means a child that's born after 9 months. We can be pretty certain that it will live. Look at what just happened. The rabbis are using our verse 22 not to teach a stringency, but to teach a leniency. It's telling you that had we only had the verse in Leviticus that says if you strike any soul, you might have thought that you're liable for the death penalty. If you kill a child that's born but not viable, you would have thought that. No! Exodus comes to teach that? Us, no. Exodus comes to teach you're only liable for the death penalty if you strike and kill a born child that is of full term. Wait a second. And therefore, if that's the way the rabbis are using verse 22, are they reading like A? Are they reading like B? Or are they reading like C?
I'm getting C.
You're getting sick, you said?
C, that too. I'm getting C from 8 months.
Yeah.
It's talking about a child already born. It was all talking about a child already born. After 8 months of pregnancy, but already born.
But what if it was... maybe I'm understanding it as being born as a result of being struck.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. The rabbis are telling us that from Leviticus, you would have thought, when it said anyone who strikes any soul, it's telling you that you're responsible, you're culpable of the death penalty if you kill a born child who was born after 8 months of pregnancy. You might have even been so severe in your understanding of capital punishment. Then comes verse 22 in Exodus says, no, you're not responsible. You're not culpable for the death penalty if you kill a child who's born, who's out of the womb. If it was only a pregnancy of 8 months, you're only considered to be a murderer if you strike a child who was already born and was in the womb for 9 months.
So you can smother it if it was born in 7.5 months.
Yes. Awesome. Yes. So I ask again now, are the rabbis holding like A, B, or C? No.
No.
Who are they holding? They're holding like?
B.
Like B.
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 B. The rabbis are reading like B. The rabbis are saying that we learn from this verse that, well, let me put it just differently.
It's not alive, but nearly it's eight.
The rabbis are saying that you cannot learn from this verse, anything about killing a fetus. The most you can learn from this verse, right, is about killing someone who's already born.
Okay, that works.
And it comes to tell you, the verse comes to tell you, according to the rabbis, that you're only responsible for the death penalty if you've killed a child that fulfills two conditions.
Why?
Born already? Born before you killed it. Out of the womb before you killed it. And the pregnancy was a full
term.
But that doesn't make... I don't get it.
That's not at all what the English says.
I think it is.
Is the English an accurate translation?
Which word in English?
Therefore.
Therefore, it says...
Men strive together, telling us that one is not guilty of death.
In other words, one is not culpable of the death penalty.
Unless he kills a viable child.
Viable child means?
Well, but it doesn't mean that the child is born.
Oh, no, it does. No, look at the Hebrew.
Unless in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
And that's the question.
Yeah. The Hebrew phrase is ben kaima. Look at the last two words. The word ben kaima means the following. Literally, it means a son of existence. Right? Literally. Son of existence. What it means is a child outside of the womb, born already, who we know medically has a good chance of survival. How do the rabbis define good chance of survival? That we know that it spent 9 months in the womb. A child that spent less than 9 months in the womb, the rabbis define as like it says here, 8 months of pregnancy, a child who is not necessarily viable. The halakha learned from here, from this passage just learned, is the following. That a child that is born already, outside of the womb.
Before the men were striving.
Before the men were striving. So born already.
It's a live person.
No. No. Not according to this. If it's born already, and you know that it spent 9 months in the womb, then it's considered to be
viable,
such that if you kill it, you're a murderer. If it's not, if it's known to be that it spent only 8 months in the womb, you're not a murderer if you kill it.
Even if it was alive.
Even if it's outside of the womb alive, but if we know it spent only 8 months in the womb, then you're not a murderer if you kill it, because it's going to die anyway.
How do you know?
This is all theoretical.
You just know if the child's going to die.
Right? So that really has nothing to do with striking a pregnant woman.
But it almost seems to render...
How did the rabbis reach this conclusion? By using our verses. So we have to understand, if they used our verses to reach this conclusion, how were they learning our verses? Right? So wait a second. So if they were learning our verses by quoting to Rick Santorum, they couldn't have reached the conclusion that they came to. Because if the verses tell you that if you kill a child in the fetus, in the womb, you're a murderer, then all the more so would it have been that you're a murderer if you kill a child outside of the womb. So they're clearly not learning like A, but they're also not learning like C. Because C says the same thing that Rick Santorum said, in that if you kill a fully formed fetus in the womb, you're a murderer. But our verses say you're not a murderer even if you kill the child already outside of the womb. So clearly our verses are being interpreted like B in order to reach the conclusion that the rabbis reached in this midrash. And what I'm saying now, there's no dispute. Everyone knows in all rabbinic literature that that's the way the rabbis read these verses. In other words, if we go back to the first page, to Josephus in Contra Apponionem, or Josephus in the Antiquities, or Septuagint, it's clear that the rabbis read the verse like the first Josephus. They read like the first Josephus.
I want to clarify. You're saying that it is the majority opinion.
Not the majority. There's no dispute.
It is the law that if a premature birth, if there's a premature birth, then it's not a crime to end the life of that fetus if it has not survived the full 9 months.
I'm going to modify what you said. I didn't say it's not a crime. I said it's not a capital crime.
Got it. Well, okay. Yeah, okay.
The rabbis will say it's forbidden to kill that fetus. But if you do so, you are not culpable of the death penalty because it would have died probably anyway.
Mm-hmm. So what does rabbinic law say about all the things that we do now for babies that are born, you know, at 20 weeks and we do
it's
all
a good thing.
This heroic
it's
stuff?
Not a bad thing. It's a good thing, right? Nothing wrong with it. Oh, by the way, all of this
is based on the fact that back then it was not considered a viable child unless it was in utero the whole 9 months or close to it.
So this is the source of Obama's position. Mm-hmm. By the way, don't think I'm a Democrat or anything. Don't think I'm a Republican, but not about politics. But it was good, I think, to see how different this is than you would have thought. That's certainly true, right? The fundamental rabbinic understanding of these verses has not changed, as we learn from these verses that a fetus is not considered to be a nefesh, is not considered to be a life in the sense that we use that word when we talk about capital crimes. Now, that doesn't mean that abortion is permitted. It just means abortion is not a capital crime. Right? It just means that abortion doesn't carry with it the penalty of life for life. It might be a crime, but it's not murder. It might be a very serious crime. It might be forbidden in all cases, but it's not murder. According to these verses, according to the way the rabbis have read them across the board for 2,000 years, we learn from here that abortion is not considered to be murder. But of course, you know, the rabbinic law is very, very, very complicated, and there could be thousands of nuances, and we only have 5 hours left to look at the sheets here, so we won't cover everything. But I think that one could defend and stand behind what we just said. I don't know anyone that would disagree who knows rabbinic literature. Let's go now and see the source at the bottom of the first page. By first page, I mean the one that has a one on it. The one that had the translation of our verses at the top. And we're going to look at the source that says Tractate Nidah, chapter 5. This is a Mishnah, which means, again, from before the year 200 of the Common Era. And it's a Mishnah that is very technical. Let's just read from the beginning up through my brackets and beyond. A girl 1 day old is subject to the uncleanliness of menstruation. Now, that doesn't mean that a 1 day old baby can menstruate. It means, in theory, we're saying that a child who exists in this world is 1 day old, already is considered to be a human being, and in this case, a female human being, with all the laws of being a woman. And of course, the point is that a state of being considered a human, female human being, is not contingent upon age. It begins at the very beginning. You're a human being, a female, from the very beginning, 1 day old. And not 30 days, and not 5 years, and not 20 years old. You have the status of a full human being who's a female from 1 day old. That's a girl. But then in brackets, I have a boy 1 day old is subject to the uncleanliness of ziba. That's a sexual emission. If a boy has a sexual emission at 1 day old, he's a boy. It's all the laws of a boy. Again, just to tell you that it doesn't begin at the age of 5, at 10, at 20, that he's a legal entity for the laws of the Torah from 1 day old. And it goes through a long list of legal ramifications of being a human being. And then if we skip down through all the legal ramifications to the one I have in brackets, he who kills him is guilty of murder. In other words, Judaism here is rejecting any legal system that would say that you become a legal entity, a human being, such that those who kill you are considered murderers at the age of 5, at the age of 10, at the age of 15. No, it begins at age day one. It's the primary purpose of this Mishnah is to tell you that by day one of your life, you're considered to be a full human being, and if you're killed, the person is a murderer. For our purposes, of course, we learn from this that before day one, not. Right? That's the point. It's from day one and not before day one that the person who kills you is considered to be a murderer. And that, of course, is in accord with what we just said. And the rabbis probably learned it from this verse, according to the way they interpreted this verse, 22 and 23.
This isn't subject to the child being fully formed.
Very good. That's what the Gemara asks. Very good. How did you know? That's the next page.
I just read ahead.
Okay. The Gemara objects exactly as Charles objected. What do you mean? You should have told me 1 day old, only assuming the child spent 9 months in the womb. But if it spent 8 months and 20 days in the womb, then even if now it's 1 day old, the murderer shouldn't be a murderer, according to what we learned. That's what the Gemara is about to say following Charles. So we turn the page.
Just call me Rabbi.
To Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Nidah, page 44b. And this is the rabbinic commentary on the Mishnah we just read. The Mishnah, we said, was formulated before the year 200 of the Common Era. And then in the coming generations come the Babylonian rabbis with their interpretation and commentary and questions and additions to the Mishnah. So here is what the Talmud asks and says and concludes on the Mishnah we just read. What the Talmud first does is quote the Mishnah. And here in this English translation, it is quoted in capital letters. He who kills him is guilty of murder. Right? That's what we're talking about. The one-year-old boy we just read about.
One day,
thank you. And the Talmud brings a verse, since it is written, and he that smiteth any man mortally, implying whatever his age. And that's the same verse we saw earlier from Leviticus that says he who smites any soul is guilty of the death penalty. So that means from one day old. Fine. And of course, we learn not earlier, but from one day old. And then the Talmud says, look at my bracket, skipping three lines in English, in agreement with whose view is our Mishnah. It cannot be, can it, in agreement with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who ruled, quote, any human child that survived for 30 days cannot be regarded as a miscarriage, end quote, from which it follows that if he had not lived so long, he would have been a doubtful case. What does that mean? That means the following. We have a child here that was born just a few days ago. Now, we don't know how many days or how many months it spent in the womb. So we don't know if it was a full-term child or not a full-term child. If the child's already 30 days, then we can assume that 9 months have passed since conception, so we're going to call it now a viable child. Because if it spent 30 days in the light of the world, it almost certainly spent 8 months in the womb, so altogether 9 months have passed and it's still alive, it's viable. But if the child has not yet spent 30 days breathing, then we don't know. Perhaps it still has not yet finished its ninth month. And if so, perhaps we should say that this is a child that will probably die. And therefore, if someone kills it, according to one of the sources we read. So that's with the information I just gave you. Let's read it again. The second bracket. In agreement with whose view is our Mishnah, that says that from one day old you're already culpable for killing it, it cannot be, can it? In agreement with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who ruled any human child who survived for 30 days cannot be regarded as a miscarriage, cannot be regarded as inviable, from which it follows that he, that had he not lived so long, would have been a doubtful case. In other words, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel holds that if a child didn't live for 30 days, we say, well, it might not yet be 9 months since conception, which means we wouldn't hold someone guilty of the death penalty if someone killed it before 30 days of life. That's what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel holds, and that seems to contradict our Mishnah that said if you kill any child after one day, you're already culpable of the death penalty. And our Mishnah didn't say only if you were certain that it already spent 9 months in the womb. So it looks like our Mishnah, as Charles said, doesn't agree with that previous material we learned, which here we are told is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that you need those 30 days. What's the Talmud going to say about this? Listen to the conclusion. Here, we are dealing with the case of a child concerning whom it is established that the months of his pregnancy were duly fulfilled. In other words, when we read the Mishnah that said that if you kill it after one day, you're a murderer, that's only if we know when the woman conceived, and we're certain that 9 months have passed since conception. But if we don't know for certain that 9 months have passed since conception, we cannot hold the guy who killed the child guilty of the death penalty. That's the conclusion of our passage, which again just goes to solidify in another source the things we learned earlier, that the rabbis seem to have a hard and fast understanding based on these verses that certainly all the while that the fetus is in the womb, it's not considered to be such that if you kill it, you are a murderer. Again, it might be forbidden for other reasons, but it's not going to be in the category of nefesh tachat nefesh, of life for life. Leslie?
It seems to follow, you know, along with some of the other stuff we learned, like with adultery or other things, like the rabbis always want to be so certain, or they, you know, don't want to do a death penalty.
Right, that, good point.
You know, very
good point.
Much, you know, any way they can, like, you know, finagle out of the finality, they seem to give you all these little loopholes, even when it kind of contradicts what you would think. like, and not to say again it's not a crime, but the finale, I mean, like a death penalty is, you know, not even the last resort almost for the rabbis.
I'm with you.
Killing your child if they're rude and behave improperly.
Wait, that is not in accord with what Leslie's saying.
No, it is. That the way they interpret it, that it's really, it makes it impossible to kill your child.
Oh, that right. Okay, on the rabbinic level. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Stuck with me.
Okay.
You've had those thoughts before?
Yeah.
Now, I want to continue hitting everyone over the head with this point, because it's a bit startling, so I want to bring another source from rabbinic literature that seems...
Can I just ask, on this Babylonian interpretation, even if it went for a full term, the child has to survive for 30 days to be considered...
No, if it went for full term, then the minute it's considered one day old, which really means 1 minute...
Yeah, but you don't know if it went for full term. I thought that was the point.
No, if you know, it says the case in which the Mishnah told us that if you kill it when it's 1 day old, that you're a murderer, that's if we knew that it was a full-term baby. But if you didn't know, and you killed it, then you're not a murderer. Again, that doesn't mean that's a good thing to do, to go around killing babies. But it's not a category of murder.
I don't know what the opposite of latches is, but it's kind of the opposite on, you know, on a treatment on a like a 6 month birth if it survives. Or
right. I mean, I don't know how the rabbis at this time of the world knew. I mean, how did any woman know when 9 months start?
Doesn't matter. It's a theory. We're not putting this into practice, and they're not necessarily putting it into practice. Right? They didn't have that many cases of people killing one-day-old babies, but it's the theory of defining, it's defining what is the entity concerning which we say nefesh tachat nefesh, life for life. And the entity is a human thing that has spent at least 9 months in the womb. Anything less than that, the law of nefesh tachat nefesh, life for life, doesn't apply. And I'll just say once again, that doesn't mean it's a good thing to kill babies in the womb or outside the womb. It just means that it's not technically in the category of murder. Let's read another source.
Is there anything written about self-inflicted abortions back then, where maybe people tried to terminate pregnancies, unwanted pregnancies, and this is kind of addressing all of that?
I don't know of such cases. But again, we don't need cases. We have the theory here, which is pretty clear. So the Mishnah in Tractate Sanhedrin, Mishnah 2, chapter 9, Mishnah 2, at the bottom of the same page, says as follows. If one intended to kill a beast and kill a human being, in other words, I shot in that direction, I went to hit a cow, the cow moved, and I hit someone... A human being, killed it. Or if he meant to kill an untimely birth, the word in Hebrew is nephel. Nephel means a child who is expected not to survive. It could be a child that's born with two heads. It could be a child that we know was born preterm. Right? Both of those in the category of nephel. Either we're certain that 9 months didn't pass, and there are cases in which we can know that, or was born with two heads, or the Gemara gives an example of two backs. I don't know what that means, two backs. So anyway, if one intended to kill a beast and kill a human being, or if he meant to kill an untimely birth, again, a nephil, one that probably won't survive, and killed one that might have lived, that word is ben kaima, one that I know will live, in other words, that it's not deformed, and I know that 9 months have passed since conception, he's exempt.
Exempt from murder.
Exempt from capital punishment for murder. In other words, if you meant to kill an animal, but killed a human being, you're exempt. If you meant to kill a fetus, or even a baby born already, but didn't have 9 months in the womb, and by mistake you killed a baby that was older, you're exempt. When are you guilty of the death penalty? either if you killed a normal human being who you meant to kill, or you meant to kill a normal human being and you killed a different normal human being. In other words, only if you meant to kill someone for whose murder you would be guilty of the death penalty, and you killed someone else for whose murder you're guilty of the death penalty, only then your intention has to have been to do a crime for which you could have gotten the death penalty. But if you aim to kill a fetus and kill the normal human being, you're not guilty of the death penalty. All the more so if you aim to kill a fetus and kill the fetus. So here again we learn that any fetus who has not spent at least 9 months in the womb is not considered to be a nefesh in the sense of if you kill it, you're guilty of the death penalty. The same position is found again and again and again in rabbinic literature. And so, I can just hit you over the head with more.
So if you intend to kill the fetus and the mother dies, you're not guilty of murder.
Right, absolutely. Because your intention wasn't to commit a capital crime.
Right. That's Jewish law?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You need intent to commit a capital crime and to commit a capital crime in order to be judged guilty of committing a capital crime. Both intent and...
So you could say that all of this means that all this rabbinic law says that abortion is not okay, murder. But it's not
right.
murder.
Not that it's okay, but it's not
it's
murder.
It's not murder. Okay.
Now, I don't have a watch. What time is it?
8:15.
Okay, so we better skip a lot of sources and move to the punchline. So we really... There's a lot of sources there. Let's just talk outside here. Let me just tell you how these laws are developed over the past 2,000 years. The majority opinion in rabbinic law, based on what we've seen, and I mean the majority opinion to this very day, is that abortion... even in the ninth month, is not murder. On the other hand, there is agreement across the board, based on sources we haven't seen, because we can't see everything, that abortion is forbidden, but not as murder. And there are various categories that different rabbis classify the crime of abortion in. One, I'm just giving examples. One is some rabbis put it in the same category as destruction of semen. Right? Just like the use, for example, of a condom is forbidden in Jewish law because it's destruction of semen. So in the same case, abortion. That's one category it's put in. Another category is a tort. And I don't know if I'm using the word properly, so I'm not a lawyer, so I'll explain myself. Just like I am forbidden from cutting off my own leg, because my body is not mine, it belongs to God. And if I cut off my leg, I can be brought to court for injuring a human being. Just like if I cut off your leg, it's the same thing. Cut off yours, cut off mine, it's forbidden in Jewish law. And many rabbis say that abortion is like cutting off a part of your body, which is forbidden. Those are two examples of categories that rabbinic law uses to classify the crime of what today is called abortion. That brings us to the next question, which is, okay, so it's not murder, but it's a crime, perhaps a serious crime. I take away the word perhaps. Take the word perhaps away. It's a serious crime, but if it's not murder, then, just like every other prohibition in Jewish law, we have to put it into a hierarchy of values and ask ourselves, are there needs or conditions that allow us to do something that's usually forbidden? And almost everything in Jewish law fits into a hierarchy of values except for the three cardinal sins of murder, idolatry, and sexual licentiousness. All of those we say you have to give your life and not commit them. But every other crime is usually forbidden, but under certain circumstances allowed. Everything in Judaism fits into the hierarchy of values. I shouldn't say everything, almost everything, besides those three. And therefore, the rabbis have been discussing for literally 1,500 years under what circumstances is the crime of abortion permitted. It's certainly permitted when the woman's life is in danger, because everything is permitted except for murder to save human life. But this isn't murder, so certainly abortion is allowed. Now, what about other cases? What about a case in which the woman was raped? It's a famous case in the 18th century. The woman was raped, and she claimed she'll go insane if this child is born. She can't bear to see the memory of her rapist. Will that be permitted? Perhaps. What if we know that the family will not be able to raise the child because they don't have the financial resources? What if we know that the child will be born with Tay-Sachs disease? Will be born simply with autism. Here, rabbinic law grapples with all these questions. Had abortion been murder, there'd be no grappling to do, because you're not allowed to murder in any case. But as long as it's not murder, it's a crime, and a serious crime, but it's not murder, therefore all these questions are on the table. Now, how do the rabbis deal with these questions? They deal with them by judging the relative severity of the crime as opposed to the condition or the need that we're talking about, whether it was rape, whether it's autism, whatever it might be, another type of deformity. And the rabbis talk about stages of pregnancy. The Gemara says that 40 days from conception until 40 days, the fetus is maya ba'alma, it's water. And therefore, almost every legitimate need, almost every legitimate need, whether it's psychological or financial, brings the rabbis to weigh abortion before 40 days of pregnancy, and in many cases, both 100 years ago and in our day, it's ruled to be permitted. Not in all cases of need, but sometimes. The next category the rabbis talk about is 3 months, the first trimester. And here the crime is more serious, but it's again weighed in the hierarchy of values. The next way station is fetal movement, that again the rabbis talk about, and weigh. In this case, abortion is even more of a serious crime. It has to be weighed against the need that's involved. And of course, the last way station is on the birth stool. Child hasn't come out yet, but pregnancy, birth has begun. What about abortion under those circumstances? And again, it is weighed and discussed.
What about selective abortion? There's cases where you have in vitro, and maybe there's six eggs that take, and it's not viable to carry all six. And they talk about selectively eliminating some of the fertilized eggs. What does Jewish law say about that?
It's so amazing how liberal it is. The last time I asked that question, the answer was, whatever you want. We're talking about the first week, right, basically. Whatever you want. Doesn't matter.
Nothing. 30 days.
Because I've known of
up
people
to, 40
that,
days.
40 days.
But I've known of people that refuse the test to find out either how many eggs are viable, or an amniocentesis to find out if all the eggs are healthy, because they wouldn't do anything about it.
Okay, that's
anyway.
Their right. We never said you have to, God forbid, commit an abortion. After saying all that, I have to add that there is a minority tradition that comes from Brisk, from the city of Brisk in Eastern Europe from about 100 years ago, that was brought and put on the table by Rav Chaim Brisk, who is the grandfather of Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, who is the father-in-law and the teacher of my teacher, of Aaron Lichtenstein. They have a reading of a certain passage in Maimonides in which they say that abortion is close to murder. It doesn't jive with all these sources, but Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, my teacher, actually teaches that. And this approach has been adopted, the one I'm mentioning now, the minority approach, was adopted by Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was considered to be the major halachic decisor of the 20th century in America. So it turns out, and now I'm telling my personal opinion, that a lot of rabbinic rulings in America, as opposed to Israel, in America, that follow Rav Moshe Feinstein and follow Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, have been much more stringent than what I put on the table in the past hour and a half. And I personally believe, and colleagues I've talked to believe this also, that this is flies in the face of most rabbinic tradition, but what can you do? In Israel, where the influence of Rav Moshe Feinstein is less felt because he was in America, there the field is much more open. And I'll just say, without saying too much, that I know this from personal experience, that when my wife was over 40, we had a case, I can talk about it for 3 hours, but I won't, in which we found out that the fetus had a certain deformity, and again, I'm not giving the whole case, and within a 48-hour period, because it was exactly before the 3 months were over, we had contact with 10, 15 rabbis in Israel, and very, very difficult, deep discussions of halakha and of emotions involved. And in the end, my wife was told to have an abortion, which she did. So I know all these things from inside. And with all the difficulties and the halakhic questions and the emotions involved. But in the end, my wife and I decided that we're going to do what our rabbi tells us, which is what we did. And I, knowing the sources, knew what was going on in the minds of the rabbis we talked to when those decisions were made. So this is real life, serious stuff. Yeah.
So how would you, you know, okay, so in Israel, there's probably more, well, agreement, disagreement about what rabbinical sources. But how would you say, what's the difference, or what's the agreement or lack of agreement, say, with Reform, conservative, and orthodoxy amongst what you just...
I don't know anything beyond the rabbinic tradition, which is called orthodox.
But what you are saying is, I don't know if liberal is the right word, but there is more flexibility in Israel regarding the rabbi's determination.
That's my impression. Because of the influence of Rav Moshe Feinstein in America. That's my impression. Yeah. Okay? Good evening. Remember, we only scratched the surface barely.